Well, good seeing you. Good to have you back out tonight. And if you have your Bibles, let me invite you to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 9 in our study of David and a matter of the heart. As I come up here on Sunday evening, I have memories of looking at Victor Loberger over in his motorized chair to your right. I went out Wednesday night. Pastor Greg went Thursday. I thought, you know, I better get out there Wednesday night just to make sure we get an opportunity to let Victor know that we're praying for him and read some scripture. And I remember when I walked up to Victor, as he was lying there, I said, Victor, how you doing? And he looked at me and goes, I'm still living. Meaning, I want to be with the Lord. And to think that tonight he is with the Lord and singing and up and not in a motorized wheelchair any longer. I am excited for Victor, and his funeral memorial service will be this Saturday here at church at 2 o'clock. The visitation is 1. Well, as we turn to 2 Samuel chapter 9, we're going to look at these 13 verses here this evening, but before we begin to read them for you, I would just like to tell you a story. You're probably somewhat familiar with it. It happened many, many years ago. It was very unexpected in a variety of ways. There was a young boy by the name of John, and his mother died when he was 6 years of age, and he really lost the only godly influence in his life. For his father was just a wicked, wicked man. When John turned 11, he joined his father, who was a sea captain, and over time, he actually moved from ship to ship along with his father. And he followed the tradition of that particular lifestyle at the time with his father as sailors on a ship. And it was primarily a lifestyle of rebellion, a lifestyle of debauchery. And his sin was so great that eventually he became a slave of slaves. He would say that he hit rock bottom. Someone actually gave John a book entitled The Imitation of Christ. And as he read it, almost in jest, he made fun of it. But eventually, in John's lifestyle of sin and debauchery, he actually became captain of his own slave trading ship. However, by his own admission, he was just an evil drunk in charge of a ship. In fact, there was a point in his life on the ship that he was so drunk that during one of the storms that had come up on them that he actually fell overboard, and his crew, hardly even caring whether he lived or died as he was screaming, decided that they would try to rescue him. And so they were able to throw a whaling harpoon at him, and they made contact right in his hip. And they caught him there in the hip, and like a fish on a line, they hoisted this young, screaming, drunk sea captain right back up on board, and it spared his life. But it gave him a limp for the rest of his life. After many years of violent storms and very severe illnesses, John finally cried out to God to save him. Making no more resolves but believing in a crucified Savior who died for him, John Newton told the Lord he could do with him as he pleased. After a stroke at the age of 29, John retired from the sea. He worked and he studied for the ministry. He became a mighty servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, and he became a wonderful preacher of the gospel. And he wrote that song that we love to sing, Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. My friend, I want to tell you that song is the song of every blood-bought, saved child of God that loves to sing about the wonderful grace of Jesus Christ, of what God did for us. Once I was blind, but now, by the grace of God, the wonderful grace of God, I now see. At times, though, that word grace, and our theme tonight is going to be on the grace of God. And I believe that that word grace is overused often today. We can refer to grace and describing a ballet dancer as she has wonderful grace there. We may say grace at meals. Grace can mean a coordination of movement. It can mean a prayer. It can refer to that which is dignified or elegant. But most importantly, grace is really and best described as unmerited favor, extending special favor to someone who doesn't deserve it in the least, who hasn't earned it. They can never repay it. Every once in a while, we come across a scene in the scriptures where we see a beautiful illustration of that kind of grace, and we stand amazed at this unexpected, amazing grace. And tonight in our study of 2 Samuel chapter 9, I believe we're going to see one of those moments which involves the life of David. You know, the Bible is not just a chronological, it's not just a chronological narratives about history. The Bible is about the glory of God. And we're going to see it in David's life this evening, a good man who will ultimately give us a microcosm of what God is actually like. God is good. And we will see aspects of God that have bled through to David's life. I believe it's one of the greatest illustrations of the grace of God in all of the Old Testament. It's going to involve an obscure man with almost an unpronounceable name, Mephibosheth. It is a beautiful, unforgettable, unexpected story of David's remarkable care for the lame Mephibosheth, who was not only related to Jonathan, but it was this love that David had for Jonathan. And that was a motivation for David, but at the root of what David did for Mephibosheth really comes back to his appreciation of God's kindness to him. David had experienced that. That's why it was David who said, "Oh, taste and see, the Lord is good. Taste it, experience it." This stimulated David to acts of kindness because David knew what it was like to be loved and cared for when no one else ever loved or cared for him. So follow along here as we read the first three verses. "Now David said, 'Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?' And there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. So when they had called him to David, the king said to him, 'Are you Ziba?' He said, 'At your service.' The king said, 'Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?' And Ziba said to the king, 'Well, there is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet.'" This evening we're going to look at some action steps of King David. And the first is going to involve his motivation. What was the motivation for David's actions? And we're going to see it here in verses 1 through 3. And I believe the first is his recognition of God's kindness. He knew God had been kind and gracious to him. I would like for us to out loud together recite Psalm 23 and verse 6. You might know it, or you can follow along there on the screen. Let's say it together. Ready? "Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Chapter 8, verse 14 of 2 Samuel says, "And the Lord preserved David wherever he went." David knew, was experiencing the goodness and the graciousness of God himself. I mean, he had just had wonderful and great victories there in chapter 8. He had seen the blessings. He'd seen the kindness of God bestowed to him upon his life. And the nation of Israel had never really experienced it in many, many years. They truly say these were the Camelot years of Israel. And I'm sure as we begin to go into chapter 9 and these great victories and wow, look at what all God has done here, and God has put me in place as the king. There is peace. We have overcome our enemies. But possibly his thoughts just started to drift to that wonderful dear friend he had, Jonathan. Oh, I love that guy. I wish he was here with me. And then he probably started thinking about his father, Saul, David's predecessor, who for years tried to take his life. And while reflecting upon those two men and the impact they had in his life, David began to think about a promise that he had made. He thought about it, and then he addresses it here in verse 1. Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake? I think David's question here is a question that just drips with grace. David's motivation here to honor Jonathan. He says, I want to do this for Jonathan's sake. Write down the word grace here for verse 1. If you're taking any notes, you might want to say, grace is given to someone who does not deserve it. I'm going to tell you a true story, but I'm going to tell it to you in a little bit different way. This happened, and we got an opportunity to meet this family in Mexico. Imagine you have a teenage daughter who is raped by a man who is drunk. After a lengthy search, the police find the man who did this, and now you have a choice. If you used everything in your means, in your power, to kill this man for doing this to your daughter, that would be called vengeance. If, however, you are content to set back and let the courts take over and administer to this man what is the proper judgment for him, we would call this justice. But if, however, you should plead for the pardon of this man, forgive him completely, invite him into your home, and adopt him as part of the family that you now have, that is grace. And we had the wonderful privilege of meeting a couple down in Mexico. And I've shared that story with you before. He was a harvester of grapes, paid pennies each day. He was one of the fortunate men in the village that even had a job, but his daughter was raped. He sought out the man, shared the gospel of Jesus with him. The man came to Christ, was baptized in the church, and now they attend and they minister together in a church. That is grace. And you see why grace is so hard to give favor to someone who doesn't deserve it. In fact, they might deserve wrath. And you see why very few people, if any at all, would be happily ready to give grace to someone that has just done harm to them. But you think about it, God does it every day. He takes the guilty, believing sinner who says, I am guilty as charged. I am unworthy. I am undeserving. And he extends the gift of eternal life because of Christ's death on that cross that satisfies the holiness and the demands of God against sin, and we are the recipients, we are the receivers of this grace. Wonderful grace of Jesus. Mephibosheth is going to be the recipient of David's grace, just like we're the recipients of God's grace. There was a former president of Princeton University that came up with an acronym of the word grace. God's riches at Christ's expense. We are the recipients of that. The Bible is a photo album filled with pictures of God's grace, and one striking image is going to be what David does for Mephibosheth here in 2 Samuel. David is just not a conqueror. He's just not a warrior. He's just not a ruler. He's just not a king. He is good. He is gracious. The Apostle Paul said it this way, for scarcely for a righteous man will one die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. I want you to circle for me the word kindness there in verse 1. And in verse 3, there's a phrase at the end of verse 3. I may show the kindness of God. David wanted to show kindness, but he also wanted to show, this is who my God is. He demonstrates, he shows kindness. And David used the same word when he appealed to Jonathan for protection way back in 1 Samuel chapter 20 and verse 8. He said, will you deal kindly with me? That's going to be the same Hebrew word. And Jonathan also used it when he blessed David and asked him to show favor to him and to his descendants, because Jonathan said, I know you're going to be the king. Will you protect my family? And he uses the word, will you show kindness, in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 14 and 15. Have you ever heard of Hasidic Jews? They are rabidly loyal and faithful to the law. This word kindness is the Hebrew word hesed, H-E-S-E-D, which is the overflowing, loving kindness of God, which led to God making a covenant with Israel and then an invitation for salvation to actually come to the Gentiles. I love the question here in verse 1. It does not ask, is there anyone here who is qualified? Is there anyone here who is deserving? Is there anyone here who is worthy? No, he simply asks, is there anyone, regardless of who they are, is there anybody still living who ought to be the recipient of my grace, of the covenant that I made for Jonathan's sake? It's an unconditional desire, a question of an unbounding, overflowing grace. And so, in this motivation for David's actions, we see the recognition of God's kindness. We're going to also see the appreciation that he had for Jonathan's love. David had made this covenant way back in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 16 and 17. If you want to turn over there, you can follow along. This is what it says. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Now Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him. For he loved him as he loved his own soul. These were dear friends. That's all it was. Don't let anybody try to convince you there was some sort of homosexual activity going on here. That's not it at all. Great love and appreciation for each other. David, a man of his word, is going to fulfill the covenant because he's a man of his word. And he loved his friend Jonathan dearly. He knew Jonathan had given his life to protect him. Keeping promises, I should say, should be a major part of our lives. It should be a characteristic of how we live. Keeping promises is going to show our character. When we say we're going to do something, that we do it. That's with our family. That's with our commitments, with whatever we have said we'll do. The character of David is revealed in the way that he kept his promise. In the same way, our character is shown in how we keep our word. In fact, David had made two promises, one to Jonathan and one to his father Saul. And so there was an obligation that David had here to Saul's request that took place in 1 Samuel 24, 21. After David had spared Saul's life in the cave, remember they wanted him to, hey, this is a chance, take his life now. And he said, I am not going to touch the Lord's anointed in this way. David said, as he spared Saul's life and he called out to Saul, Saul said this, David, and now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. So David swore to Saul. You say, well, why was Saul so determined to make this covenant with David about his descendants? Well, it was a custom. In that day, and possibly even today, in Eastern dynasties, that when a new king took over, all the family members of the previous dynasty were executed to remove the possibility of any kind of a revolt. Do you remember in the Old Testament a fellow by the name of Abimelech? He took over his father Gideon's house, And he had 70 of his own brothers killed on one stone. He wanted no one to challenge him. And so Saul knows that with David as king, his house is condemned. His house is the enemy. His house is the one that is now suspect. But the good news is that there is kindness in the heart of David because he wants to demonstrate the kindness of God. He wants to fulfill his covenant that he made with Jonathan. He wants to be true to the obligation and the request of King Saul. And what no one realizes is that David had made this oath with Jonathan, and he had promised Saul, and David is going to honor his word. And so in verses 2 to 3, we see there is some identification here of, yes, there is someone. The identification of Mephibosheth, the answer from Ziba is, yes, there is someone. Ziba, a servant of Saul, says, yes, but I want you to kind of read between the lines here. Because when you get over to chapter 16, this guy, you're going to maybe sense in the counsel of Ziba here an implication that he's going to make in the last phrase. He says, he is lame in both feet. I think that Ziba, as you read on in 2 Samuel and get to know a little bit about him, that I think really what he is trying to indicate to King David with that last phrase is, David, you better think twice before you want to go get this guy. I mean, because this guy is not going to look good in your beautiful kingdom and in your throne room right here that you've built this marvelous place. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. But you're going to have somebody that's not going to match how you have made this a spectacular room and court. David, you don't know. He's crippled. What can he do for you? I got a question for you. If Mephibosheth doesn't get the wealth of his father and grandfather, Jonathan and Saul, who do you think is going to get it? If you answered Ziba, you're right. That is who would have gotten the land and the estate. And it's going to be an interesting scenario what takes place here with David. And so we're going to see in verses 4 to 10 the measure of David's actions. So follow along here. So the king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodavar. Now let me just stop here and just say this for a quick second. If you were a Jew, you broke out laughing right now at that point. Because Lodavar is a very barren place. Okay, head north, cross the river, go into the land of the Amorites, carry on for several miles, and you're going to come to one of the most barren places, and that's Lodavar. That is where he is. It would be like us saying, all right, go around the lower part of Michigan, of Lake Michigan, and then go up into the state of Michigan and find Traverse City, and that's where you'll find him. It is going to be a ways. What's interesting is whenever David fled from Absalom, that is where he fled. He fled to Lodabar, which is way out of the way. It's in a barren place in Gilead, where this guy, Machir, a good man, receives and he cares for this prince. He recognized him as the descendant of Saul. So Ziba says, sir, he is crippled, and he is so far away. And he might even said to him, and he is scared to death of you. And David said, go get him. Let's keep reading. Then King David sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodavar. Now, when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, he just had to get that in there, didn't he? The son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face, talking about Mephibosheth, and he prostrated himself. Then David said, Mephibosheth, and he answered, here is your servant. So David said to him, do not fear, for I will surely show you the kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will destroy and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually. Then he bowed himself and he said, well, what is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I? And the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, said to him, now I've given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and to all his house. You therefore and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him, and you shall bring in the harvest, that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat at my table always. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. So there is one living descendant of Jonathan, of Jonathan's whole entire household, and it's Mephibosheth. And so we're going to see the measure of David's actions here, number two, but it's going to be measured by Mephibosheth's condition. He has a disability. How did his feet become crippled? How did he become lame? We find that in 2 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 4. It is a brief one-sentence biography of Mephibosheth. Here's what we read. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled, and it happened as she made haste to flee that he fell, or he was dropped, and became lame, and his name was Mephibosheth. So he has a disability, and he also has a vulnerability. In verses 3 and the first part of verse 6 and verse 7, because there's two elements, I believe, about Mephibosheth's condition that are stressed in this text. And the first one is this: he is a cripple. There is something, though, that's even worse in this text about Mephibosheth. It's his genealogy. Whose family he's in. He's the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul. Remember, Saul knew even before Jonathan was in his place, man, my home is the enemy. We are in trouble. Mephibosheth is quite simply of the wrong stuff. He's from the wrong side of the tracks. People would view him as the enemy. They knew what kings would do when they came in. They would eliminate everybody from the previous predecessor. He belongs to the previous regime, and yet he is spared because of David's covenant oath to Jonathan, and because he wanted to show and demonstrate the kindness and the goodness and the grace of God. In verse 7, Mephibosheth, he says to David, here is your servant, and he falls prostrate and acknowledges David, and he's saying, David, you are the rightful king. There had to come a time when we basically, in our heart, fell prostrate, knowing we cannot save ourselves because of our sin, and we turn to the rightful king, Jesus. And so it's measured here by Mephibosheth's conditions, David's actions. It's also measured by David's provisions. And this is a large part of the text here, but David takes the initiative. What a beautiful response. After Ziba shares this, David responds, well, go get him. I would love, and hopefully we get to heaven, we can see some of the instant replays. This has to be a great instant replay that takes place here, beginning there in verse 5. King David sent, and I love the King James Version, it says, he fetched him. You like that? He fetched him. He brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel. Mephibosheth, you in there? No. Yes, you are. I know you're here. Come on out. We're going on a trip. Who's there? Mephibosheth, do not play games with me. You know it's me. It's Ziva. You're coming with me, and you're coming now. Where are we going? We're going to go see the king. Huh? Yeah. The guy your grandfather tried to kill and take his life. He wants to see you. You gotta be kidding me. No, open the door. Come on. Could I take a pass till next year? No, he wants to see you right now. Can you imagine how many times Mephibosheth on that trek back asked Ziba, how far? And I gotta believe, something makes me think that Ziba loves saying, we are getting closer to Jerusalem, the city of David. And just watch him over there. Gotta be kidding me. I cannot believe we're going here. It was grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. So we see David's initiative, we see David's gentleness. I love this. Here Mephibosheth is, he's swept away in a chariot, and before he knows it, he is right on the ground in front of the king who could actually take his life. You talk about the unexpected. Man, he had been out in hiding thinking there's no way David's going to come after me. And here he lies prostrate before the king, and he is scared to death. And David says to him, Mephibosheth, do not fear. I mean, David's words must have stunned Mephibosheth. But can I tell you, they fit David, those kind and gracious words. Listen, when grace is in your heart, your hope is to release others from fear, not to create it. I want to tell you that one more time. Because if people are going to experience grace with us, it's when grace is in your heart, your hope is to release others from fear, not to create fear. And David takes away the fear from Mephibosheth. And yet in verse 8, he asks, Mephibosheth asks, what is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I? And calling himself a dead dog, he uses really the most descriptive words he could think of for a despicable, worthless creature. I mean, that's what dogs were in the Eastern world. We don't necessarily look at dogs that way here in America. In fact, we spend a lot of money to make sure they're protected. But you go over into some third world countries, I mean, the dogs are looked on in a very horrible light. And that's what he is trying to say he's like. It's interesting. He didn't come to David and he said, hey, what took you so long to come out and get me and actually give me what really is mine? No, he says this, why on earth are you doing this for me? Let me just go back to the barren land of Lodebar and let me die in my misery. I'm nothing but a mongrel. There is nothing about me that would be attractive to you, that would endear you to me. There's nothing. And we also see in verses 9 through 10, not only his gentleness, but we see his generosity. David let Ziba know that the land of Saul is going to be restored to Mephibosheth, and Ziba, you will work the land with your servants. I love that. Secondly, what the land produces, you will bring in and you will give it to Mephibosheth. And finally, Ziba, I want you to know this. He is going to be eating at my table, the king's table. Four separate times in this biblical account, we read that Mephibosheth would eat at the king's table. In verse 7, in verse 10, in verse 11, and in verse 13, David was making this a point for everyone. Basically, he is going to be one of my sons. The apparent losers in David's decision here had to have been Ziba and all the members of his household who would now turn over all the income of Saul's estate to another, and they would become really the servants of Mephibosheth. Boy, that had to sting. But Ziba, he had no choice in the matter. But when you come to 2 Samuel chapter 16, he is going to finagle a way to get part of that land back. And it wasn't a real truthful way of doing it. So we've seen the motivation for David's actions, the measure of David's. I want to look finally here at the mission of David's actions in verses 11 through 13. Follow along here as I read. Then Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so will your servant do. As for Mephibosheth," said the king, "he shall eat at my table like one of the king's sons." Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. And all who dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants of Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth, he dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both his feet. That's how this chapter ends it. I look at David, and I think he had a mission. He was very mission-minded. He says, Mephibosheth is going to live with me, and he is going to be like one of my sons. By the way, how did David's sons really fare? Well, there was Amnon. He was a rapist, and he would later be killed by Absalom's order, his half-brother, to have him killed. Absalom? Well, he led a coup, and he would be killed in battle by Joab. Adonijah? He would be killed by Solomon for trying to have a coup to take over the kingdom. Solomon, well, he reigned as king, but he was judged by God for his idolatry and his rebellion, and the kingdom split in two. David, basically, with these boys, is 0 for 4. But what son did the best? I think as you read through and even into 1 Chronicles, you're going to see Mephibosheth. When David flees from Absalom and he returns after Absalom is, his life is taken and the coast is clear and he comes back, who do you suppose is there to meet him? Mephibosheth. The whole time David is away, Mephibosheth will not bathe, he will not cut his hair, and he will not care for his feet. Because he had to have been thinking, if my king is suffering out there, I am going to suffer. Nobody, and I repeat, nobody had the loyalty to David that Mephibosheth had for him, because this boy, Mephibosheth, knew what it was like to be lost and to be found. Do you know that Mephibosheth was not really his name? If you go over to 1 Chronicles chapter 8 and verse 34, you see his name was Meribaal, and it's spelt this way, M-E-R-I-B hyphen B-A-A-L, Baal. You know what the name means? The devil's might offender. I mean, that's the worst name you could give a kid. I mean, it had to have been a bad day. You know what Mephibosheth means, though? The exterminator of shame, or idol breaker. I like the name Mephibosheth. So David is very mission-minded, but David is also ministry-modeled. He is going to model for the whole kingdom how much he cares for this boy. What a fantastic account of the grace that is demonstrated in this passage. That's why I went back to saying I think it's one of the greatest illustrations in the Old Testament of the grace of God. It's a picture of grace. Picture what life would have been like in the years to come at the supper table of David. The bell rings, or they're called to come to dinner. The meal is fixed. And along come the members of their family and their guests. Here comes Amnon. He comes walking in. Then there's Joab. He's one of the guests. He's muscular. He's masculine. He's attractive. Then comes Absalom. He had all the charisma in the world. He was probably enjoying life as he came to the dinner table. And then there is beautiful Tamar. She arrives. However, Solomon's not there. He's still in the library studying. And so they have to call for Solomon a second time. Come to dinner. But then you hear the clump, clump, clump of Mephibosheth. And he had to have been grinning from ear to ear as he is coming to the king's table. Grace had been bestowed on him by King David, who had adopted him into his own family. By the way, if you'll follow 1 Chronicles chapter 8, you can trace the genealogy of Jonathan. You know what Jonathan's name means? Who is like God? You're going to trace it 9 to 10 generations just from Mephibosheth alone. Micah, which means, who the Lord is. And Micah has 4 sons. He has 4 sons, and you read through that how God preserved the line of Jonathan through David because of his wonderful grace and his kindness bestowed upon him, thus preserving the family line of David's best friend, Jonathan. This text here is just not to provide for us with some historical literature, but to show us the kindness of David from the hesed of God. Dr. Barnhouse, that pastor and Bible scholar, perhaps said it best concerning grace. He said this, and I quote, "Love that goes upward is worship. Love that goes outward is affection. But love that stoops low is grace." To show grace is to extend favor or kindness to the one who doesn't deserve it, and they sure haven't earned it. Perhaps you might be starting to sense a parallel here between David's devoted love for his enemy, Mephibosheth, sort of thing that wasn't supposed to happen, and something like Romans 5:10. Romans 5:10, "For even when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son. Much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by this life." You will never really appreciate David's covenant love to Mephibosheth unless you understand the source of it. And the source of it comes from the author. It comes from God himself. In fact, it's not Paul's purpose in Romans 5, 6, and 10 to highlight the who could have guessed quality of God's love. Look at his argument there in Romans. He says, "While we were yet helpless, while we were yet sinners, while we were enemies." Friends, we are the Lord's Mephibosheths. And there is absolutely no reason why we should be eating at the king's table other than the grace of God that has been demonstrated through his son Jesus, who loved us. His grace is shown to us by sending his son to save us. "For God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance." God is the ultimate good shepherd who seeks the lost. What's interesting about this narrative is if it wasn't even there, we don't miss anything of what was going on in David's life. God wanted this text here for us to see a visual picture of that wonderful grace and that grace that he has bestowed upon us. D.L. Moody, the greatest evangelist in his day in the 1800s, had a song leader by the name of Ira Sankey. And both of these men were from Chicago, and both were equally as famous. In 1874, they are on a train from Glasgow, Scotland, where they had held revival meetings for 4 months, to Edinburgh, Scotland, where they would hold additional meetings. As they're on the train, Mr. Sankey is a little bored, and so he had bought a paper before they got on the train. And he kind of flipped through it, and he was bored with it, and he just kind of tossed it aside. He tried to rest, but he really couldn't rest, and still bored, he thought, well, maybe I missed something there in the paper, and he picked it up and started going through the advertisements there in the paper. And all of a sudden, he had something there that caught his eye. It was a poem that had been written in 1868 by a 21-year-old Scottish girl by the name of Elizabeth Selfane. And she had wrote this in search of her prodigal and wayward brother. Ira Sankey, as he read this poem, was captivated by the title of the poem, "The 99. Remember, he was on that train in 1874. That poem was written in 1868. It was the simplicity of the poem that intrigued him. He called out to Mr. Moody on the train. He said, "Mr. Moody, you have to listen to what this poem says. And he started to quote it to him and recite it to him. And Mr. Moody was just disinterested. He was reading a letter from someone that he'd gotten, that had mailed him an important letter from Chicago, and he was engrossed in this letter. And Mr. Sankey, a little discouraged that he didn't want to even follow him with this poem, just, again, thought, eh. And he ripped out that section of the paper, and he put it in his pocket. I mean, Mr. Sankey wasn't even listening to him. That evening, as they had arrived, they were at their first meeting in Edinburgh, and one of the greatest Scottish preachers was speaking, Dr. Horatio Bonar. He spoke on God as the Good Shepherd. Before the meeting closed, Dr. Moody leaned over to Mr. Sankey, and he whispered to him, "Mr. Sankey, can you close the service here with a solo about the Good Shepherd?" Can I tell you, preachers have always been good at asking for things at the last second. Listen to how Mr. Sankey described what took place from that point on. He said, "When Mr. Moody said that to me, I thought, I have nothing in mind, and I was greatly troubled. How am I going to end the service? He asked me to end the service with a solo. Well, the 23rd Psalm came to my mind, but we had been singing that song throughout the meeting for some time, and I knew that once I started to sing the 23rd Psalm, the Scottish men would join with me in singing, and thus I didn't fulfill the obligation to have a solo. So as much as I wanted to sing that, I thought, no, I can't do that. And I just prayed, and I said, Father, help me. And all of a sudden, it was like I was impressed to sing about the poem that I had read about in the train. But I found that impossible. There's no music written for this poem. And I just erased it from my mind, but it was only for a half a second because it again was impressed upon my mind. I could not get this song, this poem, out of my mind. So placing the newspaper clipping there on the organ in front of me, I lifted my heart in prayer and I said, Father, would you help me? I don't even have a tune for this poem. And I need to sing it so that people might understand. And so laying my fingers, he said, on the organ keys, I struck the key of A flat, which I believed was a good key for a Scottish audience. And with the guidance of God, note by note, the tune was composed, and it has not changed one note from that day to this day. And when the singing had ceased, I heard a great sigh from the audience, and I knew then it had reached the ears and the hearts of my Scottish audience. Mr. Moody was greatly moved, and leaving the pulpit, he came over to where I was seated there at the organ, and with tears in his eyes, he said, Sankey, where did you get that hymn? I have never heard anything like that in my entire life. Mr. Moody, this was the poem that I was trying to read to you on the plane yesterday, but you weren't interested. Mr. Moody raised his hand and he pronounced the benediction, and the meeting came to a close, but the 99 lived on. It's a sentimental Victorian poem. It's a sentimental gilded age tune, and it represents the heart of a broken girl reaching out to her wayward brother. For some reason, we don't sing it very often. But you can read about scores of people who were saved by just reading this hymn. It's not simply a song about God. It's about you. It's about me. And I don't know of a Christian today that cannot listen to Elizabeth Selfain's poem written over 150 years ago and not say when they hear it, that's me. That's me. I have been able to experience the grace and the love of God. He came and he was seeking the lost sheep and inviting the sheep, that lost one, come home.